leadership is not amoral. Leadership is not unethical. If you don't have good morals, now that is a vague term for different people, and I think there's some flexibility.
Then you're not
that.
A real leader.
Then you're not a real leader.
I totally agree with you. You're a misleader. Yeah. You're misleading. Yeah. You're right. It has a morality aspect. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to call you a leader, then I am already implying there. If I say, Rachel, I think you are a good leader and you have a potential to be a great leader, I'm implying that I approve of your moral objectives.
Yeah.
I am saying something about you as a person in a positive aspect also. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call someone a good leader just because they can influence people. Arguably, no other individual has had such an impact on the modern management zeitgeist as the prolific journalist-turned-management consultant, Peter F. Drucker. And if you are a manager of any sort, you should have at least a basic grasp of the many ideas and concepts Mr. Drucker contributed over his decades-long career. To make that easier, many of his more influential writings have been compiled into one relatively slim volume entitled The Essential Drucker, which, as the last episode in the Essentials of Management series, Rachel and I review and riff. And with that, welcome to the Introspective Leader Podcast, where Rachel and I take a deep dive into the ideas and practices that will help you become a more effective and respected organizational leader. I am Stuart, and as a retired Army Senior Non-Commissioned Officer, a former hospital executive, and a management instructor, I have been leading and managing for almost 30 years and teaching it for over 15. Rachel is an Army officer and a healthcare practitioner. And while she is relatively new to the gig, she is one of the most talented young leaders I have come across. So thank you for joining us, and we will see you on the other side. Hey, you. Before we get back to the show, just a quick reminder. If you're enjoying it, give us that 5-star review and share it with at least one other person who you think will also enjoy it. That's it. Back to the show. Hello again, everyone. I'm Stuart.
And I'm Rachel.
And welcome to the Introspective Leader Podcast, where today we will be reviewing and riffing off of The Essential Drucker, which is a 350-page compilation of some of Peter F. Drucker's most notable writings. And for those of you who may not know, Peter Drucker was a journalist turned management consultant who made it his life's work to understand and communicate the practices of management and leadership as he witnessed them unfold. Drucker also became a major figure in the development of management education and first introduced the now widely known and practiced concept of management by objectives. Born in 1909, Mr. Drucker was in his mid-30s when he began to witness the evolution of the first corporate enterprises, entities that are now both ubiquitous in developed societies and aligned with what we refer today as modern management practices. And according to John Burns and Lindsay Gerds in their article, The Man Who Invented Management, he predicted many of the major developments of the late 20th century, including privatization and decentralization, the rise of Japan to economic world power, the decisive importance of marketing, and the emergence of the information society and that society's most critical component, the knowledge worker, which is a term Drucker coined in 1959. Whoa. That far back, huh? We all have our detractors, however, and Peter Drucker was no different. The crux of the criticism came from the management academia realm, with some PhD-level scholars labeling his conclusions as mere conjecture and stylistic flourishes that were not founded in the rigors of scholastic research. Sounds like a lot of the professors I know. Despite such criticism, Drucker remains in many people's mind the key thinker associated with modern management practices, with some even referring to him as the father of modern management. And with that, we are going to jump right into our takes on the book, or more accurately, on many of the ideas and concepts Mr. Drucker presented through his decades of writing and consulting, and that are now available in one relatively slim compilation, which is known as The Essential Drucker. Rachel, you want to start us off?
Yeah, so I liked this book. He definitely was a journalist. You can tell that his writing style is great.
And that probably surprised you a little bit, right?
Yeah, well,
was expecting something a little more dry. I mean, it is relatively dry.
Yeah.
It's management writing. I mean, it's not poetry, but
no, but he definitely, it was very smooth. It was very smooth, nice. I mean, like I said, it's just, it shone through that he had a writing background before he decided to do some of his books and writing. I mean, I will say the only note about the book that I would have appreciated is, because they break it down in like 26 little chapters, I would have liked, like, and maybe they compile things so they couldn't have done this, but I would have liked a date, like a year of when was this written? Because as you said, Stuart, his first book was like 1940.
Late 1940s. Yeah. I think it was 1949, I think. Don't quote me on that, but it was in the 40s somewhere. Mm-hmm.
And he wrote up until his death in like 2005.
Right up to it, yeah.
Yeah. That's a huge period of time.
Yeah.
and the social and cultural dynamics changed so much during that. And some of it you could tell because some he would talk about like post-Soviet Union world and you're like, okay, well, that's after 1989. But then other times it's like, oh, I don't really know when this is. So I would have liked that. And I think that would have been helpful just to place the reader in the cultural moment, you know, especially people who have more business knowledge and business history, experience and knowledge. I think that would have been helpful for them, but
for sure. I totally agree. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking that out loud several times. Now, because I have read Drucker through the years, a lot of it for college stuff, I was able to a little bit kind of place it in a general time frame because I was able to place it with the book they pulled it from or the general area. But even I wasn't really sure at times. Mm-hmm. But I think it would be also really beneficial for the reader at times to see how prescient he was in his predictions. Because like we said, that's why I sort of threw that in there. He came up with the term knowledge worker in 1959.
Yeah.
We didn't even have the full blue collar movement yet. And he's talking about switching to a knowledge worker society.
I was going
to
say,
I mean, nobody had computers or that kind of stuff.
I didn't realize that. Because you've used the term knowledge worker so much with me, I didn't realize that he coined it, and I didn't realize that that first section about that was wrote in 1959. Because you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, this could have been in the 90s, and obviously they like had full blown like that was like the knowledge worker wave. I think had definitely started by the 90s.
You're reading this and you're like, yeah, tell me something I don't know, Peter.
Yeah,
and then
right.
when you realize that he started talking about this. I don't think it was fully fleshed like most things aren't when people bring it up. But he started talking about the concept of a knowledge worker back in 1959. Eisenhower, I think, was just barely out of office. Think about it, people. I love Lucy still going strong in 1959, I think. Yeah. But yeah. But I agree with you on the dates. I did find that because what I did immediately was look in the back to see if they had the dates associated them where they originally come from, and they didn't.
So that would and some of it was helpful because it would sort of place you. He referenced a couple of times. He referenced, you know, hey, I used to think this in these publications, but now I think this, and so you were like, okay, well, it's got to be after these dates. So anyway, it is a small thing. I think the whole book is great anyway.
I agree. Yeah.
But I do think that could have been helpful.
No, I agree.
So moving on to my actual points about the book and his ideas. So one of the first things that stuck out to me, and again, this is where it would have been, I think, super helpful to know when this passage of writing was from. But he has a section that where he talks about how businesses should be invested in helping create a healthy society, because if you don't have a healthy society, you can't have a healthy business. And from my experience, and just my experience living in the world, and this is something Stuart and I were talking about before we started recording, I do think more and more companies are starting to think this way. But from the way I feel, I do not feel like anyone before. I'm sure some companies here and there, but it wasn't in like the societal zeitgeist, right?
Yeah.
For organizations to be talking about taking care of society in the way they currently are until, I mean, maybe 10 years ago, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe if that, maybe a little bit further back, depending on the sector that you're in.
And I agree with you. I want to make sure that what I said before we started recording, we both agree it's moving more towards that way. But I want to make sure that you understand that I agree that it definitely is not some absolute expectation minimum bar standard now that companies have to do that.
No, I do not agree with that. No.
I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah.
I agree. I think you worded it correctly. It's starting to trend more that way.
Yes.
At least at very least, at a superficial level.
Yes.
Right?
Right. At least companies are realizing they need to market that.
Yes.
Some companies are realizing they need to put on a face that they are thinking about societal levels, at least in certain aspects of society.
And I do think there are more larger companies that actually are walking the talk, if you would, also. So
right.
I do think there's a proof enough out there that some that actually are committed to it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead back, Rachel.
No, that was
I'm glad that you're bringing up that point.
That was like my, because I think that, and again, this is another place where, not to go back, not to keep hitting my point of, I would have loved some dates, but you know, really, if he wrote it at some point before 2005.
Well, I can tell you that he wrote that. He had been saying that very, very early on.
Okay.
Not as early as, I don't think, again, people, I am not a Drucker scholar.
Yeah.
There are Drucker scholars out there, and I got to be very careful. But I don't get hate mail. He has a strong following.
Yeah.
You know, not... He's sort of the management equivalent of like Taylor Swift or something like that,
well,
right?
That's not even a vote
or
her name.
Beyonce. You don't want to get into the Beehive. You don't want to get into the Drucker, whatever you would call him. But he came up with that well before you consider it was a common thing to say.
And I definitely wonder,
well before that.
Yeah, because I do. And again, this is potentially some of my lack of historical knowledge showing, but I do feel like in like the 20s, right, we had in the United States, at least, we had a big progressive movement, right?
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah, and so I wonder if these are a lot of the ideas that we as a society are revisiting around what work should look like and what interactions between businesses and employees should look like. Obviously, they're very different because we have, you know, computers now, but the work-life balance concepts
are definitely echoing a lot
of the same language as...
Because they were even going down to three-day work weeks
back then. Exactly.
I mean, some of them more... And that was actually being seriously considered like 4 or 3 day work weeks, you know, to us. We were like, oh, how do you do that?
Yeah.
I believe it can happen.
Yeah.
But anyway, no, you're right.
Yeah. So I wonder
sure
if some of that was
influenced
him, because he would have been young, but alive in that time.
Yeah.
And this looks like he was a fairly well-educated man. And so I wonder if part of it was that, and I mean, it does, like, it intuitively makes sense. If you can't, when Rome fell, business was probably not doing great that day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like, when your society is collapsing, you can't really have business because you don't have customers, which is one of his big points is the whole point of the business is a customer. If your customers are rioting in the streets for their own personal rights, or if, you know, they're underwater because climate change has destroyed them, or they're on fire, business has nobody to sell to.
Well, yeah, and I'm really taking it simple down, and mainly because homes are really at the forefront of my mind right now of the big life change I'm going through. But much simpler and a lot less variables. But I will say this. It's like people who buy a nice home, and that's their home. And if you just take from that home, and you don't do the necessary repairs and updating and all that kind of stuff, it's going to eventually crumble on you, right? Or definitely lose value, right?
Yep.
So in a much more complex way, it's the same way. If you're a business, I don't believe you're outright tethered like a ball and chain to meeting every societal demand out there.
That doesn't even make sense.
No, it does not make sense. But it does make sense to try to contribute to the playground area that you're playing on, where you can continue to play on it, and then people after you can continue to play on it.
Because I think that's a, you know, it's before we had management and business, before we had organizations the way we do today, and Drucker talks about that a little bit, is we had small town farmers, we had small town businesses, and they were all, I mean, it was stuff in the community. And obviously we don't live in that world anymore. And I personally think that's a good thing. I like the current world we live in, at least in that capacity. But it's very easy for the big businesses to be like, well, we're not really part of this community, so we're not going to give back. And that's when you start to see that decay of the society and the communities that these businesses are in don't trust them. And it's a lot of time, most of the time, your workers are coming from that society and community that your location is in. And if they don't trust you, then that just bleeds into every interaction people have with you as a company and as an organization.
And Rachel, that really triggered something for me. That's the danger. And Drucker talks about this in his book. And I'm sure you'll remember it as soon as I bring it up, is that's the danger of business saying, our sole purpose here is to make money for the shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And Drucker, again, pretty well ahead of a lot of other people, was saying making money is not the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It's necessary. you can't be a true business if you're not making money, if you're not making a profit. But that's more of the scorecard.
Yeah.
And that's more of a necessity to keep you running and do all those things that you need to do.
It's almost like a byproduct.
Yes, it's a byproduct, a necessary byproduct, but it is not the purpose. He says, he said that throughout his writing career. Making money is not the purpose of the business. Mm-hmm. Your purpose needs to be your mission or the product you're selling or whatever that is.
Creating value for your customer was a big thing that he talked about.
Yes, exactly. Because he was a, like we said earlier, he was a very early mover on marketing, seeing the importance of marketing. But that's the danger when companies just say, hey, my purpose isn't here to give back to this. All I am required to do is make money. And then there's this trickle down effect if I do that, right?
Oh, no.
Because that's where that comes from. Yep. That's exactly where this comes from. If I make money, then I've done my part. Mm-hmm. Then the next level order effect happens and happens. And we have found that
I was gonna say,
be a fallacy.
I would say, to not be fair to people who believe in that in historical
But it's
times.
Not true.
Yeah. Maybe something to try, but it's been, what, 40, 50 years since then.
Yeah.
And we know that, like you said, we know that that is not
it
true.
It did not
it
work.
It didn't work.
Yeah.
And we have evidence about that now.
Yes.
And so yeah, I think it is about investing in the community.
Yes.
Not just from a monetary place too, but also from a, you know, I think that is... It makes you, and that's the thing is you do got to be careful because it's easy to turn it into a marketing thing and people are on high alert.
No, I agree.
But there is a way to do it genuinely. And people can tell, I think people can tell generally, people can tell the difference between, yes, we're doing this for marketing, but also we genuinely care and not, I mean, not care, but we genuinely are invested.
Yeah. Because marketing is amoral.
Exactly.
I mean, churches market.
That's true.
I mean, nonprofits market.
People market. PETA
markets.
Everything.
What's market. Those damn commercials about those dogs in Humane Society that makes my wife bawl every time they come on? She'll like leave the room. Of course, that's marketing. But no, I get you. Mm-hmm. I think the real thing is to look, are you doing it purely as a messaging standpoint that's something that really doesn't have your true commitment?
Yeah.
Or do you really mean it? Are you really invested in it? Mm-hmm. And that comes pretty easy for people to figure out.
Yeah.
It doesn't take long to figure out if you're putting your money where your mouth is, right?
No, I agree. Just briefly, I'm glad you brought up the fact that he talked a lot about how the main purpose of a company is not to make money, because I think in today's day and age where it feels like businesses just want to exponentially grow forever, which is literally impossible, that it would be helpful for them to think about the fact that that is not their goal. You literally cannot exponentially grow forever. That's not how any finances work. And I do feel like that's the way a lot of, you know, social media companies and, you know, freaking Netflix is like laid off a whole bunch of people because they're trying to make more money and they're trying to constantly have new subscribers. And it's like, that's not necessarily like it makes in my mind and in a lot of customers' minds, I think it devalues your product.
Oh, for sure. I totally agree with you.
I see that you're cutting, like I'm on Twitter and I see, as long as that's still around, I see these artists who are talking about like, hey, Netflix just laid me off because, you know, and then I see that Netflix is also cutting down on, you know, we can't share passwords anymore. They're not quite to that level, but they're getting close. And then I get an email a couple months later. Oh, Netflix is bumping up your cost by $2 a month. And it's like, well, I'm just going to go use Hulu, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Or I'm going to get Netflix when a season of something I want to watch comes out and not get it the rest of the year.
Now, it is important to point out, I know I always sound like the Netflix. I'm actually... have gotten a little down on Netflix myself recently because I definitely thought there for a while they were putting out some good premium
TV. Well, they do.
And I think they still hit it here and there. I do see a lot more junk than I thought they put it. I mean, think that's part of them wanting to control the entire market of it. But to be fair with them on this sense, they have yet to be profitable. So Netflix has not been profitable yet once they went this. I don't know if maybe they were when they were doing the mail-in CDs.
that was basically a different organization.
Destroying Blockbuster. Yeah. But they're not profitable, to be fair. But I definitely agree with what you're saying as far as it seems like so many of these companies are in a sprint when it's really a marathon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And like, why are you just sprinting to get bigger and bigger and more money and more money when And I know it's about power. I know it's about control. And I also know there's things that we don't see from the outside.
Oh, 100%,
so I get all that. But definitely from a perception standpoint, I don't like it either, because it does seem like there's such this fascination. It goes way back to when the first ones to really do it was, and I actually just listened to a great podcast series on it from Wondery, wasn't Business Movers, or maybe it was, can't remember, I'll write it in the show notes, but it was about John D. Rockefeller. True, like, you know, antitrust was first really put to use because of John D. Rockefeller,
that made him
break that company up into, it was like hundreds of different separate companies, because his goal, he was like filthy, silly rich, and had all kinds of control and power, and constantly was just trying to grow and grow and destroy all forms of competition. Mm-hmm. And I think that's some of what you see. I think we as humans never have enough. And that is just that on steroids, right? We're never happy with where we're at for very long. Mm-hmm. We always want more. So it shouldn't be too surprising that the people that are running these companies are not much different than a lot of us. It's just more.
It's bigger.
On a bigger scale, right?
Yeah. No, but that's just what I was thinking of when I was reading through his sections on the goal of your company is not to make money.
Yeah.
That's not the main goal.
It's
not the purpose.
That's really good. Yeah.
It's not the purpose. The purpose is customers. The purpose is customers. The purpose is, what are your objectives? What are your mission? And then you need to be able to make money as well, and you need to be able to make a profit as well. Otherwise, you can't provide the things to your customers and you can't accomplish your goals. Money is a key tool in that, and profit is a key tool in that. But it is not the objective, hopefully.
Yeah. And also add in there, you want to make enough profit to be able to give a good, decent, nice return to the people that's invested in your company.
Right, exactly.
You know, we always talk about, shareholder value, it's become too big of a thing. And I agree, it's become too big of a thing. But it's also important to remember, these are just people that put money in, and they do it on a very transactional, selfish way. They're not doing it, I believe in you, Rachel, so I'm going to give you some money. They're doing it to
Here's
make
business
money.
Plans.
But that's part of the contract, right? That's part of the deal.
If investors didn't make any money, then there would be no more investors, and investors are an important part of new businesses.
Exactly.
So that's all important,
but that is not the purpose.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. I've always believed that. I believe in the power of capitalism. I just think, again, like a previous podcast we just recorded, it's a word that, to me, it's kind of a word you can sort of make it what you want to make it.
Oh, capitalism can mean anything. Yeah.
But in my definition, it's not all about just the pure focus on money. It's letting the markets and the demand and need, which involves the customer, decide what succeeds, what fails, and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. Moving on to my last point, he talked about, and I think this, what you did say, he wrote in like the 60s, I believe, he wrote about, he was one of the ones who predicted the rise of Japan and like the industrial,
They became an economic power.
Economic power. Yeah.
That's mostly through industry, which of course the car industry is the one we're most
And Sony. Sony was a big one. He talked about Sony a lot. And he talked about, in Japan, they had created these basically, I mean, what I was thinking of when I was reading it is where you hear like the Google complexes, right? They created these places where their employees were living there, they were eating there, they were sleeping there, they were working there, obviously. And they create the idea that initially he was like, the idea is work will replace community and it will replace essentially like towns. And it kind of did that in Japan, but it wasn't good. And so he, a few years later, at some point, wrote like, hey, I thought that this was going to be a good thing, but it wasn't a good thing. And I thought that was very interesting to see that in this day and age reflected in the Google complexes. And I know I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but the WeWork company, they did a similar thing where they had people who, I believe it was WeWork. Yeah. They had people who were living in these complexes and going to work at WeWork offices. And in that documentary, it basically highlighted how, I mean, I don't want to throw the word cult around lightly, but it was this idea of all your friends are work friends. You eat it, like everything you're doing is tied back to work. So it becomes a lot harder to leave a job that is not good for you when you're also going to lose every other part of your life.
Right? Yeah, it's easy to start feeling like an indentured servant.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And I was actually, it's funny you mentioned that. I read a novel last year, I believe, called The Four Winds by, oh, I can't remember the author's name. But it was like a literary fiction, like historical fiction novel. But it was set in like the California like farm boom of like the 1920s, because I think it was like, yeah, it was during the Depression. And so there was a family that moved from Texas. And basically the mom, and I didn't even realize this was a thing that happened, but in California, they would set up these towns where you had to pay to like, you had to pay for your food and you had to pay for your house. And your employer would give you lines of credit to pay for it. And they wouldn't pay you enough to ever pay it off. So you were basically stuck there, and they could increase the price of the food and then just give you more credit to buy the food. And then they would increase the price of rent and they give you more credit to pay for your rent. And so you're literally trapped.
Yeah, that's serfdom.
Exactly.
That goes right back to the practice of the medieval ages. Which the lords did over the peasants.
Exactly. Yeah. Which I don't think Google is doing that. But but I think it's just a very... We've talked about that on the show before. That can become toxic so quickly.
Well, what I told you when we talked about it earlier, what I think it is, it's a sign. And again, I'm not saying what Google necessarily is, but when we're talking, when the organization is trying to become the end all and be all, to me, it's a form of patriarchal leadership, which to me is one of the worst forms of leadership, because it's so insidious. Mm-hmm. What I have found, not always, but most people, and I've worked in the medical, working with a lot of medical people, they tend, whether they know it or not, really take on a sort of a patriarchal kind of role, mm-hmm. especially the providers. Yeah. Like it's sort of how they're made up. It's how they're programmed. They tend to be some of the smartest people in the mm-hmm. room, especially in certain aspects.
People ask them their opinions all day, every day.
Exactly. So it's understandable, and I think it usually comes from good intentions. I'd say almost mostly from good intentions. But does it mean that it doesn't have just as damning effects just because it's coming from a good place? I think patriarchal leadership in today's society, first of all, is very demeaning.
Yeah,
it does not allow you people to feel empowered, to feel like, and you're not allowing them to have a sense of agency. I find it very destructive. And I really have always been quick to point that out to someone if I think they're doing something along that vein. Yeah. And again, it was tried here very early and not way before, I guess right during the time that Peter Drucker was growing up and being a person. Hershey, I can't remember his name, but the guy that actually founded, Hershey Chocolate, he had Hershey Town. It's called something else now. It's still there.
Yeah. I know my uncle was actually born there, which is how I'm familiar with this.
Was it Hershey, Pennsylvania?
I think it is.
Okay. Yeah. But it was a whole, that was it. The everything, the homes, the church, the schools. It was a, what we call them now, factory town, right? Yeah. But a literal owned by the company. Mm-hmm. And in that era, it was seen as a good thing, and he had really good intentions. So I think there was some positives to it. But the negative.
It's basically a small dictatorship to an extent.
Again, and I feel you start removing the self-agency of people when you do that. That's the negative they associate with, like, communism, if you will. I'll stay away from socialism because socialism can be a little different. But definitely communism, you remove any kind of sense of self-agency or self-ownership, right? For the good and bad that happens to you. That's the danger of it. And give him props for saying, hey, I think this is great, you know? Because he was like any of us. He was building off things he had seen as he was developing. And then he saw, okay, I was wrong. That's next. And it makes sense. Japan, it worked that they actually got it in. So it's kind of sort of fits the culture of Japan, that they are more of a collective type of culture than we are as Americans are. But again, I definitely see, I would not. Now, it's funny. We trashed this a little bit, but both of us, me especially, for 20 something years, lived in that exact society in the military.
Well, and I
how evil socialism and stuff was. I'm like, you're in socialism. This is socialism. They provide everything for us.
Military personnel are the only people who have nationalized healthcare in the United States.
And never will go out, never not have a place to live. Not have food. Nope. Never. As long, you could be in the biggest trouble you would still be having a, you and your family would have a roof over your head and food and at least the minimum amount of clothes, not to mention a free gym, decreased groceries. So I always thought it was funny. They would be like, yo, socialism, it's dangerous. You are living socialism.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, speaking of this, because I want to say that I don't want to throw Google on the bus. I think Google is one of the first example. All of this stuff exists on a spectrum, right? I do not think Google is extreme as the Japanese companies that he was talking about. I think it's the closest thing that I'm aware of that we have in today's day and age. I do think also part of that is they built that because it's in San Francisco and freaking nobody who can work in Google can even afford to live in San Francisco, which is a whole other issue, but whatever. But I did want to say, like, on the note of the military, I do think this is, I see that with some of my patients who are potentially having to get out of the military. Sometimes the reason they don't want to get out is because they don't have anywhere to live and they don't know where they're going to go and they don't know what they're going to do. And, you know, it's a great recruitment tool, but it also, when you're in it, like you lose a huge, when you are in that environment and you are in, that is all you are, you can feel really lost and like you've lost. And obviously the military is more, it's different than probably what it's like to work at Google. Although I don't know, I've never worked at Google, but.
And I will argue it's necessary to have that type of structure in the military.
I agree.
Neither one of us are knocking the military for that. We're just saying that is the epitome of what we're talking about when we're talking about an organization run community or society, if you will.
It makes sense to have that in the military.
Yeah.
I don't know that it makes sense to have that in other businesses because I think there needs to be a bit of separation even military personnel.
Yeah.
But I think there needs to be even more separation between allow for some people to have more separation between their work life and their home life, because otherwise it can just get, I mean, some people who don't work in community workspaces like that don't want to leave their job because of their friends and their work friends, right? So imagine if your work friends are also your only friends, right? And they're the only people you ever see and they live next to you, right? Like, you're definitely not going to want to leave then. So anyway, I think that's it's interesting to see. I don't want to say history repeating itself because it's slightly different with the Google, but I do think, I don't know what the pressures were in the Japanese companies to do that. Yeah. But I do think part of the pressures in Google is the housing market crisis in San Francisco specifically and Silicon Valley in general.
And I think filling a need that is a legitimate need and filling a niche, that's different, right? That's okay. If you're like trying to address something that, like, say, because there's a housing problem in Google and they're doing things because they're addressing a specific problem in a specific area, it's like anything else. It can exist on a spectrum, right? Yeah. You know, we're not telling, I think we both agree that organizations should try to provide some kind of healthcare benefit, right? 100%. So we're not saying an organization shouldn't have any involvement in the societal aspect of their employees. It's just dangerous to have that where they have this full level dependence.
Where they're totally replacing
the role of the government or of the outside community for some of this other stuff.
Yeah, it's like, have you realized your perk of the great Google cafeterias? Have you and the perk of like providing cheaper housing? Have you realized what you've set up? Like, because I do wonder if some of them have done it accidentally. Like, they don't know that I think it'll be interesting to see if people, I'm sure people are studying this, like studying those subcultures within these communities and seeing like what impact does this have on people? Because I don't know that they are doing it intentionally. I don't think they're intentionally trying to, you know, I don't want to say trap, but you know, they're not intentionally trying to create this very insular community, but they may be accidentally doing that.
Yeah, no, I'd say their real goal is it's just an incentive, right? You're trying to get the best tech workers, right?
Exactly.
There's a high demand for tech workers. You're just trying to have another little shiny object to attract them, right? So
that's all my points.
Cool. I just got a couple things I'm going to throw out. As we said earlier, one of the biggest things that I really like about Drucker, or one of his the ideas that I appreciate the most, and you've heard me talk a lot about it on this podcast for those of you that's listened to several, is the idea of the knowledge worker. He did coin that term, and he started talking about that, like we said, way, way long time ago. What specifically also I like that he talks about with the knowledge worker is he really talks about, with the rise of the knowledge worker, organizations and employers got to understand it's a different type of relationship than it was in the past, right? So his, I'll really take it down to keep this brief. What he's saying is, in the workers of old, if you would, the blue collar workers or the workers that worked for Henry Ford, or the ones that worked in factories, they did not own any of the capital. Yeah. The capital was owned by the organization. They owned the conveyor belt. They owned the machines. They owned on the screws that you got to screw in all day, every day for 8 hours. Mm-hmm. They owned all of that, right? With the knowledge worker, Drucker contends, and I agree, the knowledge worker, by the sheer nature of the work they do, which is knowledge, they own their capital. Yes, they're having to use the machines and they're having to use the software and the applications of the company. But that stuff is just more window dressing than anything. The true capital for the organization is the knowledge that is possessed by the knowledge worker. Mm-hmm. So it sort of flipped the script a little bit in those knowledge industries. Mm-hmm. So his argument there is, because of this flip, you can't treat them like the employees of old. You can't have this command control, micromanagement type of style, because that is not going to work with knowledge workers, because they can take their capital, which is inside their head, and take that right down the street to the next organization. I think the best way to sum up his argument is actually take a quote right out of his book on this, and it goes, "Altogether, an increasing number of people who are full-time employees have to be managed as if they were volunteers. They are paid, to be sure, but knowledge workers have mobility. They can leave. They own their means of production, which is their knowledge," right? And right tied in with that, he talks about, because of that different type of capital, and that capital is within the heads of the employees themselves, is you never really could manage people. I mean, I guess you could. The more power you had over them and the more you own the capital, the easier it is to sort of manage them, if you would, air quotes here. But with a knowledge worker, you are not going to manage them as people. So what he's saying is you now are managing for performance. And that's where his whole management by objectives comes. Like, this is what we want to achieve, and this is what I'm going to manage, the performance to achieve the objectives, not you. I'm not going to be over your shoulder. I'm not going to try to tell you how to do everything, because you're the knowledge worker. And you know, I've been experiencing this my whole career. I've always managed people with skills that I don't have. So I definitely had to just sort of naturally take on that type of management style. So I'll give one more quote that I think he that he says what I just said, but I, again, being Peter Drucker, I think he words it better. So, quote, "One does not manage people. The task is to lead people. And the goal is to make productive the specific strengths and knowledge of each individual," end quote. That's really all I wanted to say on that part of it. I think it's sort of self-explanatory. And I think we're seeing that when you see those tech people talk about, we no longer need management, we just need to lead. They're coming from that perspective because that's the type of people that are managing. Now, we've made arguments in previous episodes that, yes, there's more and more knowledge workers, but they're not all that's out there. And when you say you no longer need management, they're talking about you no longer manage people, which I totally agree with that. But really, you never really should be managing the people per se. You should really be managing the process and that you need to get you to the objectives that you want.
Somebody's coming up with the objectives in that.
And
maybe you get some help from your knowledge workers in building those objectives, to make sure they're not unreasonable. But somebody is coming up with the objectives, and that's partly the role of management.
And I think that's become a huge part of it. Coming up with objectives, coming up with the mission, coming up with the vision.
Coming helping, up with the procedures.
Yes, and we've said this 100 times.
Removing obstacles. Yes,
removing those obstacles and impediments. I think that has become one of the biggest roles of managers in the knowledge era, if you would. All right, moving on to one that's very related, and my second and last one. It's really also a very similar way he sort of addresses leadership. And Drucker is one of the earlier ones that talked about leadership is far less about charisma or specific traits, and it's more about a mindset and a series of habits. Again, people have heard me talk about this before, about a lot of things, but also about leadership and management. It's not something magical or mystical that's like it's particular just to a type of personality. What leadership really is about, and this is what gets a lot of people, it's really just about wanting and accepting responsibility, developing that trust, having goals that align with leading rather than misleading. I love that he uses that misleading. He calls Hitler and Mao. He was really on Mao.
He was.
Nobody even talks about Mao anymore, but Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, he was really on them about, called them misleaders. What he said was they had charisma, at least within their culture, right? And they could be called, and again, I got to be real careful with this because there's a really, it's easy to, they could be called an effective leader in the sense that he influenced
people
to get to do what they wanted. He wanted them to do, right? I love the way he worded that protects people like me that try to say things like that. And he says, but that's misleading.
Yeah.
Okay. It's showing leadership in that sense of being able to influence people to get them to do what you want. And in a lot of their cases, it was coercion.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of people that voluntarily did what a lot of these guys wanted them to do very early on, especially, right? And what he says misleading comes from is not having the right qualities and objectives in mind. It's all about what separates leading from misleading is about your goals and your objectives, what you're trying to accomplish.
I think we can all agree that Hitler, Stalin, and Mao had the wrong objectives.
Yes, of course. If there was anything as true, if anything like true evil existed, they were especially Hitler was true evil. Yeah. But I'll throw the other guys in there. Hell, I don't care. But I think it is important, and the reason I'm hitting on that is because true leadership is more than about just influencing people and charisma and getting them to do what you want. It's about doing it with the appropriate objectives and goals in mind.
Is what you're doing ethical? Is it moral?
Yes.
Does it even make sense? Because sometimes people are charismatic. And they're not, certainly not to the degree of like a Hitler, but they're just leading people down a path that's just to failure. Like the freaking, like the FTX company or like, you know, like a lot of the, like the crypto stuff where, I mean, I would argue that's pretty unethical too. They're basically just scamming people out of money. But some of those people are like really, I don't know them because that's not my world, but from the outside looking in, like they're good leaders, they're powerful leaders. They convinced a whole bunch of people to do stuff. And that stuff was scamming people out of money.
Exactly. Yeah, and they may be using some of the same tools and things that more successful or what we call true leaders, people that led for the good side, right? If you want to say, they may be using some of the same deals, but they've got the wrong, they have bad objectives.
Yeah. And I think that's an interesting piece. I don't know if you want to talk about it here, but thinking about leadership. And we've talked about this in various podcasts probably, but it just came to me thinking about it like this. Leadership is not amoral. Leadership is not ethical. Leadership is grounded in, if you don't have good morals, now that is a vague term for different people. And I think there's some flexibility.
Then you're not a real leader.
Then you're not a real leader.
I totally agree with you. You're a misleader.
Yeah.
You're misleading. You're using the same tools. And again, we can argue some of these guys use more coerciveness, and I don't call that leadership. It's just being a bully and able to get more resources than the next guy. But no, I totally agree. Leadership is, you're right, it has a morality aspect. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to call you a leader, then I am already implying there. If I say, Rachel, I think you are a good leader and you have a potential to be a great leader, I'm implying that I approve of your moral objectives.
Yeah.
I am saying something about you as a person in a positive aspect also. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call someone a good leader just because they can influence people.
Yeah.
I'd be like, you're a little rascal, man.
Right,
charlatan. Yeah. You're using this little charisma, whatever you have, for evil. You're not a leader. You're a charlatan, right?
Yeah. But yeah, I just think that's an interesting, because I think we do tend to try to make a lot of this stuff, this like the objective views of things.
Yeah.
We try to make them amoral and like, oh, you could apply this to any situation. But I think it's important, and I think that's an important conclusion to come to.
I think it's great.
Leadership is, it is not amoral. And like I said, I do think there is some flexibility in what different people consider moral.
No, I get that.
There's some gray areas, right?
And before I move on to another little point about leadership, the only thing I also want to add on this one is that thing about it not being magical or mystical. I never really rounded that off. What I'm getting at, it's like so much other stuff, is it's really done successfully by those who learn.
Yeah.
They start with themselves, then they learn, they look for what's out there, what people that are successful, what they did, what tools they have. They learn to customize it towards themselves. And then it's just waking up every day, land of steady habits, hard work, staying with it, knowing you're going to get discouraged, knowing you're going to get disappointed, and just waking up the next morning and being optimistic and moving forward with it. Leadership is like, so like Kristen Adeed said, like Mr. Marquette said in his book, Turn the Ship Around, it's just really hard.
Yeah.
And it's just the successful leaders that have a good moral compass and then have the background and ability they need, what separates them from others that would be otherwise equal to them, is they just get up every day and they keep doing it and they keep working hard, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, my last little thing about leadership that I like Drucker meant, it ties right back into Mr. Marquette's book that we just did, was Turn the Ship Around, is Drucker also brought up this notion of that the best leadership is about attempting to build a culture and systems and processes that outlast your tenure as a leader, far outlast your tenure. Easier said than done. Mm-hmm. We talked about how it's very difficult to do that when you're being judged only on your performance at that time, and nobody is really going to be able to hold you accountable once you leave. Actually, it can look good for you when you leave. Like
if
Bob Iger left Disney and,
oh,
it's all going to crap again. Let's bring Bob Iger back, right? But the true, I think, any leader, your true goal, and I know I have thought this way. I'm bragging myself a little bit much in this episode, but it's, I know I have always approached it.
Yeah.
To me, I always felt like I really wasn't achieving if I didn't at least do my part to where I think I've set it up to where the area I can control can continue to do well long after I'm gone.
Yep.
Now, if someone gets in there and just trashes it and says, I don't give a crap what he did. I'm not into all this touchy-feely kind of stuff. We're going to do it the old school way. Well, there's nothing I can do about that, right? But I am going to try to create it to where it can continue way past me, because I do see that. Again, it's not because I'm some Mother Teresa. I see that as my form of immortality a little bit, right? If, that's there, it still has my DNA on it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on here before we get out of this one?
No,
Rachel?
I don't think so. This is a bit of a longer read than our previous
book. 355 pages.
Yeah. But I think it's written well. I really liked it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I liked it. Again, I had been exposed to him a lot, but it was sort of like going home again, reading some of the stuff. And you're right. He's a good writer.
He is
a good writer. And I think that has a lot to do with his long-lasting success. But he also has a lot of good ideas. And even if you don't agree with him, he presents them really well. He makes good arguments for him. And he comes off as the person that's also I'm open to changing. And you know what I mean?
He explicitly said that once in the book was here are three books where I said this, and now I'm saying that. I was wrong. He wrote that, which, my Lord, freaking nobody does that anymore nowadays, or hardly ever. People are not willing to immortalize the fact that they thought they were wrong. I think that he definitely, to a degree, at least in that example, displayed some open-mindedness.
Yeah. Well, folks, I do recommend it, reading it. I think if you're going to study management or even leadership, because he also deals a lot with, the leadership concept, if you're going to get involved in it, you should read some Drucker. And if you're just going to read some Drucker and you want to try to read what some, at least some people think is some of his best contributions, mm-hmm. or a good smattering of them, if you would, try this book out, mm-hmm. The Essential Drucker. It's definitely worth a read. It's still not too long. It's 350 pages, and you're definitely going to impress your sort of management friends, right? Yeah. By knowing some of Drucker. Okay. Well, Rachel, thanks a lot. And everyone, we will see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Outtake. With that, we are going to jump right into our takes on the book, or more accurately, on many of the ideas and concepts Mr. Drucker presented through his decades of writing and consulting, and that are now available in one relatively slim compilation. And I write this shit myself.
Okay. Well, you weren't reading it when you were writing it.
I've gotten to where I do that more often. Anyway, one, two, three.